The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
What ancient household items are almost never preserved?
At what point did society become a patriarchy?
And will I ever write a novel?
Your questions answered on this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Every now and again, we devote an entire episode to answering questions that have come in from Time Team members around the world. And we get a lot of them, don't we, Martin?
Yeah, we get a huge number of them. And to be honest, the last few weeks, they've just been a deluge, I think. Last few weeks and over the Christmas period as well, we've just had loads and loads of people get involved in it and ask you, Helen, a question. So we've got so many to get through. So I reckon we just crack straight on here with this. If you are wanting to ask a question, you do have to be a Time Team member in order to do that. When you join up through Patreon, there's a special chat section where you can contribute to the kind of podcast chat that goes on and ask a question through there as well. I do try and respond to everyone that asks a question, but sometimes I'm quite late in doing so. So I think I've been responding to people from about a month ago recently. So I'm very, very sorry. We do read all of them and I do respond to all of them, but I'm sorry that it's taken me so long to do it. Also worth mentioning as well in this podcast, Helen's Find coming up very soon. So Helen's going to be talking about an object from the past with a really unique story to tell. So we're going to get to all that after a couple of questions. First one comes from Sarah, who's in California, who says, "Hey, Helen and Martin." I get a little mention here as well. "Throughout the years, Time Team Digs have talked about the importance of Purbeck marble, especially in Roman times. I know that there are a number of historical sites in the Purbeck district, including Corfe Castle. Has there been much archaeology around the mining of the stone? Do we know if Purbeck stone was popular before Roman times? And are there any other resources from the area that were also prized and traded for?" Purbeck marble then. So what would that have been used for, Helen?
Purbeck marble, it's actually a limestone, so it's not a metamorphic rock at all. It's just a, in some ways, an ordinary sedimentary rock, but it's full of tiny, weeny little fossils, little kind of snaily shell things. In its raw state, if you like, it doesn't look that exciting. But when you polish it, it goes black and shiny and it looks really like marble. There has been a lot of work on its use as a building material and its use as a craft material. What it's been used for, who uses it, how it was moved around, and so on and so forth. But Sarah's question about the mining of it, or strictly speaking, the quarrying of it, because it comes from these open cast mines or quarries rather than a kind of closed mine, is that Well, the usual problem with studying any kind of mining, which is that as you quarry it, mine it out, you're destroying the evidence for the previous miners, if you see what I mean. Rather than an archaeological site building up, you're taking it away. And so it's one of the hardest things to study methodologically, ancient quarrying and ancient mining. So a lot of the time, people have just assumed the quarries have been used for longer, we don't know how long, and also assumed that lumps on the beach have been picked up and made into smaller objects. But the question of the pre-Roman use of Purbeck stone is a really interesting one. I feel a bit tentative about answering this because really it's a question for Derek. Derek is local to the area. He grew up near Corfe Castle and he's also interested in prehistoric industry. So I did actually text him and ask him what I should be looking at, and he gave me a few pointers to start me off.
Oh, good on you, Derek. Thank you for that.
That was really kind of him, except that what he alerted me to the Proceedings of the Dorset Natural History and Archaeological Society, Volume 81 for 1959. Unsurprisingly, I have not managed to locate a digital copy of that.
Well, it is unsurprising because there's about a million books behind you.
You've got a library there.
Yes.
Although don't forget that because I have very low ceilings, there isn't as much as there might be in somebody else's house.
Okay.
They just haven't digitized that far back. But if you think about what's going on in the pre-Roman eras, in prehistory, we don't have those kind of monumental stone buildings that would have used Purbeck marble. So Purbeck marble is used in the Roman period. It's also used particularly in what you might call the decorated phase of medieval church architecture. So that's late 13th, 14th century. It fits in very well in terms of the colours with all the effervescent, effusive shapes that you get in the decorated period. It's definitely my favourite period of medieval architecture. So it's used a lot then. It's also used for objects, and that's where it might be used in the Bronze Age. There is certainly some evidence in that tantalising Dorset Natural History and Archaeological Society volume that I haven't been able to look at. So I think we ought to get Derek to come back and talk about this. But I would like to also alert you to Kimmeridge Shale. Now, Kimmeridge Shale occasionally gets into an Anglo-Saxon grave in the Dorset area. It's a black stone that will take a polish, very like a Purbeck marble, but it's not got the fossils, so it doesn't have that lovely speckledy effect. What it's really like is jet. So it's shiny and it's hard and it's black and it's really, really attractive. In the Anglo-Saxon period, it doesn't make its way very far out of Dorset. It's much more common in the late Iron Age or early Roman period, and then it can be found all over the country. There's lots and lots of working sites on the Isle of Purbeck where it's made into these objects. Mainly, the commonest one is a rigid bracelet or a bangle. They're very popular, very common. They break quite easily. Bits of them are often found. And the other extraordinary thing about the Kimmeridge Shale, because it's an oil-bearing shale, it will literally burn like coal. It's almost like a kind of coal.
Right.
If you broke your bracelet, you could just chuck it into the fire and watch it burn. So maybe there were far more of them in the past than we would ever know about now.
I understand what you're saying about how it's very difficult to archaeologically demonstrate that mining took place, because by the very nature of mining, you are taking stuff away, so then you haven't got anything to discover.
Mm.
Is it then at that point that you look at things like Stuart Ainsworth's landscape archaeology, so you can tell that a landscape has been changed by man, but then also the written record? I mean, would there be any written evidence that a mine would have been in a certain place?
Sometimes you can work it out from some written records, but they don't tend to tell you that mining is going on. What they tend to do is maybe give you a receipt for the finished article. It appears in accounts, because so much of history is accountancy, really. It's writing down money that comes in and money that goes out, who owes what to whom. Sometimes you can get an idea of, say, the lead that's coming out of the Peak District. You can see that that's going into churches that are writing it in their accounts. But that only works for historical periods. So for prehistory and for most of the Roman world, where documents really don't survive well, you're confined to the archaeological evidence. the Holy Grail really is finding the workshop, and lots of workshops for Kimmeridge Shale and some for Purbeck Marble have been discovered. But that tells us about the making of the objects. It doesn't tell us how they got the raw material out of the ground.
Interesting stuff. Sarah, thank you very, very much for that question. I think the questions this week, Helen, are really sort of testing you because they're pulling you in so many different ways, because I don't know whether you've had a chance to have a look at all of them yet, but they're sort of mad. They go off in all sorts of different directions.
They are so eclectic. As I scrolled down to look at which questions you'd picked, I just thought, oh my goodness, you know, this is so broad, and it makes you realise that archaeology, there's no limits to archaeology. It's as wide as the human state itself.
Let's get a question from Jacob, who says, much of preservation in archaeology depends on soil acidity, bacteria or spores, humidity and seasonal changes. What are common household objects in Anglo-Saxon or Roman archaeology that are known historically but never show up today because they don't preserve well? So these are the things then that maybe would have been all over the place, but because they degrade really easily, we just can't prove that they were ever there. We can't find evidence of them in the ground.
Yes. Well, on the whole, this question always tends to be answered by people saying, well, look at the organics, look at the textiles, look at the skins. I mean, obviously, once you've tanned a skin and you've made it into leather, then that is a way of preserving it. So leather lasts better than just skin.
And wouldn't wood be top of the list here?
Yeah, because it's so abundant. You might put bone in as well, but bone actually preserves quite well. It's hard, it's dense, it doesn't rot as easily. But wood, yes, Jacob's right. If you are in a damp place, it's very susceptible to attack by all sorts of things that eat it. The thing that I feel is really understudied and underconsidered is basketry. Because if I look around my house, I've got a laundry basket made of basket. My waste paper baskets are made of basket. My log basket is made of basket. And they're not the first
ones. Made of basket? What do you mean? Like, is that, it's a building material basket? What? Do you mean wicker?
Well, I mean, wicker work. A basket can be made of rush. It can be made of withies. It can be made of all sorts of things. You know, in the 70s, there was a fashion for making things out of paper straws. That's a form of basketry. It's woven plant material. It's not carved out of wood. It's not jointed like wood. It's woven out of flexible plant material, which can be anything that will survive long enough to be worth the work. And given that a skilled basket maker can make things pretty quickly, it's a bit like crochet or knitting, they can be really ephemeral things. They are much loved by woodworm, so they don't last long. They're always the first thing to be attacked. A lot of things that we think of as, they in inverted commas, ought to be made out of pottery or metal, something like tableware. Well, we all know about chicken in a basket, scampi in a basket. There's a bread basket. We just don't think about basketry as much as we should. And I think that's the one that has completely disappeared. You only find bits of basketry as impressions on pottery, really. Very occasionally a charred piece of basketry where only the carbon remains. And so there's nothing there for the organisms to eat. So basketry is the thing that I would point to as the one that doesn't preserve well. But there are two little stories that I want to tell you, Martin, about my experiences with this kind of thing. And the first one is when I first left university, me and my friends, we all went off to do different things. And one of us, my friend Rob, went off to the University of Edinburgh to do a PhD on wet wood, wet Bronze Age wood. And he was specifically looking at how damaged axes make a signature in the sharpening of stakes. But as a result of this, I got to poke around University of Edinburgh's wet wood lab and he showed me a Neolithic wooden spoon. And I just could not believe that it was Neolithic because it looked so incredibly like a modern wooden spoon. And I remember saying to him, do you think my wooden spoons could last this long? You know, if I handed them down, I don't know how old my spoons are. I know I got some of them from my granny, but how long could they last? You know, we were both in our 20s, and so we both said, oh, I don't know, maybe they could. The older I've got, the more I've realised that wooden spoons don't last long at all. The ones that I got from my granny, she probably bought when she was in her 80s. They last a decade at the very most.
No, they don't. I've got wooden spoons older than a decade.
Maybe you don't cook as much as me.
Well, there is that.
I don't know, but I don't think they last that long. The other story is that near where I live, there's an obvious sight of a house. In the spring, you can see bulbs like snowdrops and daffodils and so on. The trees that are planted in the area have definitely been planted. They're ornamental trees. They're not natural. But there's no house there. And apparently the story is that it was a thatched cottage made from wood, timber framed with wattle and daub and so on, and that it was owned by some people from London, you can imagine. And at some point in the 1960s, they stopped coming to their weekend cottage and it disappeared. I do know someone who says that he went in and he took the remains of the aga. And other people might have gone in and taken other things that were there. But none of the structure now remains. The thatch has all rotted. The wood has all rotted. The wattle and daub has all rotted. There seems to have been no brick. It's just melted back into the environment. And that's a really good kind of case study that most of what was built in the past would have been made out of these organic, biodegradable materials that simply go back into the ground. And it's only relatively recently, I mean, that's why there's so much archaeology from the Roman periods onwards, because it's only really since then that we've used a lot of things that don't rot. You know, pottery is the most obvious one. It doesn't rot, can't be recycled. It's the ultimate rubbish. And that's why we find so much of that.
I think now then what we need to do is do a spoon audit, a wooden spoon audit. How old is your oldest wooden spoon?
And it must be one you use every day.
Yes, it must be one that you use regularly, not one that you display in a glass cabinet along with all your other prized spoons. Yeah. Very good. So we're at the halfway stage in the questions. Got two more to bring you in just a little bit. But we break now for Helen's Find. Now, this is the bit of the podcast where Helen, in her role as a finds liaison officer, talks about a particular object, and a very old object with a story to tell. So what have you chosen from the vast cache of objects this time?
Well, sometimes it's really difficult to know what to choose, and an object just worms its way into your brain and refuses to leave. Since our last episode and our chat about the Carnix,
the war trumpet thing,
yes, absolutely. And this idea of music in the past, I keep thinking about it, because most of our senses, you know, we can't get the same effect through our senses as you would have done in the past. You can't see or smell or taste something that is completely as it would have been in the past. I have had the experience of standing in one of St. Wilfrid's crypts, the one under Ripon Minster. It's amazing to be able to look around and think everything that I can see here was built in the 7th century. But of course, you've got the electric light. It's never exactly the same. But with music, with a sound, you can shut your eyes and you can literally have an experience that is exactly as it would have been in the past. I think it's the closest you get to travelling through time. So I thought that we could have a look at another probable Iron Age musical instrument. And I'm sorry that this one again comes from Norfolk. It was found about 10 years ago and it's now in Norwich Castle Museum, where research is still ongoing. And I think we need to revitalise some of this research because there are still a lot of mysteries associated with this object. It's called a sistrum, which is a word that really means a rattle, but a rattle has connotations of a baby, really. This is a kind of grown-up musical instrument, percussion instrument, if you like. It's a set of 15 bronze rings. They're kind of flat, and they are in graduated sizes. So the smallest one is about 4 centimetres in diameter. That's about 1.5 inches. And they go up and up and up and up to 21 centimetres in diameter. So that's about 8.5 inches across. They're a set of these rather flat, rather featureless rings at first sight. They're all identical and they've all got these very slightly convex sides on one side that's highly polished and one flatter and rougher side, and they were found as a group. Now, they're thought to fit together to make this rattle, or maybe two, because 15 is quite a lot of rings. Other ones have fewer. And they would have fitted along a central support maybe of wood, maybe of leather, something like that, that's now disappeared. I don't know if anybody's tried to do any experimental reconstructions of these things. The weird thing is that I think, again, like the Carnix, they're very rare in Britain. The parallels come largely from southern Italy and from Sicily. That's a long way away to have parallels that don't seem to be any closer. And in southern Italy, in Sicily, they are found in women's graves, always adult women, and they tend to be put on their midriff. They're mostly slightly smaller than this one. The best preserved one, I think, had 9 rings. Astonishingly, they date to the 8th century BC. So that's the kind of transition between the late Bronze Age and the early Iron Age. They're remarkably early and interesting things. And what they think in Italy, which is where they've been most studied, is that the women who are buried with them are maybe professional dancers. Oh. And so maybe this thing is a musical instrument that's used in dancing. It's maybe like castanets. I think that's the one we're most familiar with. Or maybe like a tambourine that you rattle against your hip or something.
Yeah, I can imagine some musical instruments, you know, that you used to play at primary school. You'd get them out the big box and they would be this central, often wooden pole. And from it, yeah, you would have different metal things that would rattle and, you know, as you shook it around would make different noises. I will say at this point, by the way, if you want to have a look at what we're talking about, the link to the Portable Antiquities Scheme and the entry that you need to find is in the description of this podcast. So do we think it would have made a kind of like a clattering noise like a rattle, or would there have been a sort of ring element to it? I'm guessing a sort of clattering.
I'm guessing a kind of clattering, but the trouble is that we don't know. Certainly, this is the first that I've ever heard of. All of the parallels that I've seen cited come from southern Italy and Sicily. It may be that I just don't know quite enough about musical instruments, but it's crying out to be reconstructed. And although if it is used in women's dance, it's a very different milieu, if you like, from the war trumpet. But should we be trying to get together a kind of Iron Age band?
Yeah.
That is something that I would love to see. Brass and percussion go very well together.
There's so much, isn't there, that we can talk about music from the past, because we only have so little of it that we can replicate because it was written down, you know, and we have the descriptions of the musical instruments so that we can physically recreate them, and then we can see what music they would have played because it was written down. But before that, it's sort of anyone's guess, really. There probably would have been a bit of percussion, you know, like this, but would they have sung with it? Would they have chanted? Would they have done harmonies? I mean, as a music graduate, I'm very interested in that sort of thing.
Yes, the possibilities are endless, aren't they? Thinking about our conventional music of today, that's very different to conventional medieval music. And beyond that, though, we can't go in time. We can only go to other societies around the world. Their musical traditions are extraordinarily wide and various, aren't they?
Yeah, and even things like the scale, the, you know, major scale, minor scale, all of that, and the tuning of how we identify the difference between one note and another.
Yes.
In other musical traditions, in non-Western musical traditions, that is completely different. And there's nothing to say that the music, the sounds that people were listening to thousands of years ago would have maybe more resembled something that we associate now with other non-Western cultures. And we have very little way of knowing, because most of the time those sounds would have been created by the human voice and wouldn't have been written down.
Yes, and so our intervals are arbitrary.
Mm.
Maybe what you are hearing in, I mean, obviously the human voice produces such a massive range of sounds, but the other sounds that are coming into your ears, birdsong, animal sounds, rustling, rhythms, heart, there's so much to conjure with, isn't there?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to put myself down for the Iron Age band and we'll work out who's on what instruments when we know what the instruments are. Let's do that.
Yes. And I think that one thing you have to remember about this sistrum from Norfolk is that If you'd just found one of those rings, it would have been almost impossible to identify. So there may be more out there. We just don't know. You have to have that in your mind as you're asking your questions of your object. We have no idea what it's doing in Norfolk. There was nothing else found in the same field. And there hasn't been anything since found in the same field. It's a mystery.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the Time Team podcast, Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And Helen is answering questions from Time Team members who've got in touch via our Patreon chat. And we've got two more. And as I've been mentioning, these questions are very, very eclectic this time. They're all over the place, which is brilliant. Exactly what we want, because it puts Helen to the test and keeps her on her toes. So let's go to a question from Karis. This is Karis Meehan, who says, I'm working on my PhD. Well, already I'm very impressed with you. This is a PhD on female knights in the 1000 to 1500 Anglo-French literature. Wow. That's incredible.
Just before the Norman conquest to the end of the medieval period, isn't it? It covers the whole of the medieval period, England and France. That sounds absolutely fascinating.
Karis was wondering, patriarchal societies and religions are pretty widespread throughout global history. Is there a point in time or a specific event or sequence of events that led to a cultural shift away from more gender equitable? Now, I had to look this word up. Gerontocracies, which is, and I've looked it up, it's where the elders the sort of heads of the society, as opposed to a specific gender being the controlling dominant force. Yeah. It's the older you are, the elders of the society are the ones with all the power. So has it gone from that towards this more male-centric, women as lesser societies? And Karis goes on, the Abrahamic religions have played a significant role, but ancient Rome, Greece, Egypt, and Sumer weren't exactly matriarchies. Women may have had some rights, but they still weren't equal. I've had a few thoughts and ideas, but without launching into an essay of waffle, I'm sure it wouldn't be an essay of waffle, I was wondering if anyone had any insights or further reading recommendations, please. What are your thoughts on it, Helen?
Well, as you were reading it out, I was thinking the one thing that links these questions this week is that they're questions that have probably got to be answered in prehistory. They're very deep questions that have roots a very long time ago. And this question, Karis's question, I've often thought about as well, because there's no obvious biological or evolutionary reason for women to be second-class citizens. And I accept that on average we're smaller and we're weaker, but we're obviously just as good at running things, as making decisions. We're as wise, we're as clever. And if you look at it rationally, if you have a society that discriminates against women, it should lose out against a more equal society because it's disadvantaging itself by ignoring women. So it's not using its resources as effectively. That's often the argument for a lot of anti-discrimination laws in the modern era, and it's just as true in the past. We obviously find ourselves in this question, was there some kind of golden age when men and women were more equal? Now, the first thing I thought was, well, is this a question for archaeology at all? Because a lot of people are drawn to archaeology because it can't see gender differentiation. It's just about people. We don't know if it's men or women. It's just people who are doing these things. So it's not always ideally suited. So should we turn to history? Would there be historical evidence of a society where men and women were more equal? Well, it's really hard to find that historical evidence. And I think that's because by the time a society's got to the point of writing things down, it's already become patriarchal, as Karis suggests. It's that elite patriarchy that writes the history. So even if women were doing quite a lot of important jobs and so on, they wouldn't have been deemed important enough to get into the history books. So Karis also suggests we could look at religion. And some people would point to the powerful female mother goddesses that are supposed to be around. So like Gaia, the earth goddess in the Greek world, or Nerthus in the Germanic world, or maybe Isis in ancient Egypt. These are often used as examples of a kind of early dominance of women. But other people have pointed out that you can equally find powerful male gods. And the myth of the great ancient mother goddess doesn't really have very much evidence behind it. It is just a myth that has become popular because we rather like it. So I'm beginning to rule out archaeological evidence and historical evidence and theological evidence. What have I got left?
And yes, what have you got left?
Well, actually, I think, again, like with the music, it's a question for the anthropologists. So there's been work on modern hunter-gatherers, and this is where I might give a reading recommendation. The anthropology department at UCL has done some work looking at gender differentiation in modern hunter-gatherers, and it shows that if you live in a hunter-gatherer society in the modern era, you can't afford to discriminate against women. They've looked at cultures in the Philippines and in the Congo, and wherever you go around the world, hunter-gatherers tend to share power between men and women. There isn't so much gender differentiation. But the minute that agriculture develops, when humans begin to move around less, so women can have more children, they begin to lose their power. So I think that's the crucial moment. It's the development of agriculture where the rot sets in. As with so many aspects of life, you have to work a lot harder, and that leads to patriarchy. Having said that, I would be really interested in seeing what Karis thinks, because she's clearly been doing quite a bit of thinking about it. And it would be interesting to see what other Time Team members think as well. So, you know, if you've got an answer to this, do write in, because it's something that I don't think we'll ever be able to prove. We just need to build up lots of bits of evidence and almost have kind of thought experiments.
And I suppose as well, we are thinking of this from a primarily modern and from a Western perspective. We're looking at the societies that we know and understand, and we are saying that predominantly they are patriarchies. Is there an argument as well to saying that slowly but surely we are taking steps towards getting away from that now? I'm sure it can't be argued that we're in a position now where we can say we're not in a patriarchy, but could there be a situation where we can say that we're out of it? I just think there's so many avenues that you can take this, and that we shouldn't be, our judgment on society and how it develops shouldn't be clouded by what's happened to ours.
You're right. And another thing to bear in mind is that it's one of those subjects where what we would ideally do is look at other cultures that have not been so affected by Western contact. And basically, there's almost none of them.
Some Amazonian tribes and things like that.
Yeah, but they've all been, there isn't any current culture that is living in a kind of untouched state that has been allowed to develop naturally and normally and has not been horribly affected by what we in the West have done to the world. It's incredibly difficult to do the kind of anthropology that you might have been able to do 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. Of course, that was before anybody was collecting any of this evidence. There's just been so much influence and so much damage and so much pressure put on societies that work differently to the normal Western society that it is really difficult to find evidence of different ways of being. So we're dealing with very tiny fragments wherever we get our evidence from.
Well, we'll park that one then for now, and I will be interested to hear what other people think about it. And it's also one where I feel like you have to tread quite carefully, because otherwise you open a can of worms that you don't want to open about sort of modern society and all of that sort of stuff.
I must say,
we need to go there.
It's much easier for women to discuss this subject perhaps than men.
Well, yeah, you could be right. Let's finish though on a less controversial question, and it comes from Michael. This is Michael Crouch, who said, "I enjoyed the podcast interview that he did with Sir Tony Robinson, and I'm very much enjoying The House of Wolves, which of course is Tony's brilliant book. I just wondered whether Helen has an urge to write a novel, and if so, what would her subject matter be? I'm guessing East Anglian Anglo-Saxons." Oh. Yes, so come on then. If you could write a novel, what would it be about? And have you ever thought about it?
Well, I must say, I have actually. I've often thought about it because, you know, I've had friends who've written novels. Francis Pryor's written a novel. Obviously, Tony has written a novel. I've known other people who have done this. And I've often wondered why I've never had the urge to do it. And I used to write a lot of journalism, but I'm finding that more and more difficult as the years go by. And that used to worry me. But then I read something by the archaeologist and the writer Max Adams, who I've known for years, and he also teaches creative writing. And he said on a blog once that just as if you practice, say, playing blues guitar, you get good at that, or if you practice classical guitar, you get good at that. So similarly with writing, if you spend every day writing huge amounts of tiny detail about obscure objects like I do, that is my life, then you'll get good at that. And maybe your ability to write short, snappy prose might suffer because of that. So that really cheered me up reading that. And I thought, well, maybe when I retire, I'll change to a different kind of writing. There's still plenty of time. It's not set in stone what you're good at. You're good at what you practice. And actually, I think that what I like is just the writing. I just like to write things down. It helps me think. But writing is no good without a story to tell. And Tony was driven by the story that he wanted to get down on paper. He wanted to explore the story. Maybe I need to find the right story. But if I did, I don't think it would be a way of trying to find out more about East Anglia in the past or East Anglians in the past. I think it would be about archaeologists in the present, because I find my own tribe endlessly fascinating. Why do we do what we do? And also, of course, we're often in these funny groups, you know, in keeping with our discussion of music last week and this week. It's a bit, groups of archaeologists are maybe a little bit like an orchestra. We're thrust together into a common purpose. We work together, and often we work together on short projects like Time Team does. And then we go away and we regroup. And it's murder mysteries are often written about these small, tight groups.
Well, right, you've been inspired. I've been listening and I've been thinking, I think I've got it. So it's a murder mystery, but it's a group of archaeologists and they've been sent to some remote place where they've got no contact with the outside world. Like, I don't know, their phone signal goes.
An island.
Yeah, yeah, and they come across a murder. They think they found an ancient body, but then they discover, no, it's not an ancient body at all. It's actually very recent, and they have to solve the murder using their archaeological skills.
My goodness. Martin, you've got to write that, because I think that would sell really, really well.
It's exciting,
but,
isn't it?
But it's not one for me, because, I don't know, call me old-fashioned, call me prissy, call me something, I don't know what. But for some reason, I don't like a murder mystery. I feel, maybe I'm a bit uptight, but I feel that murder isn't a... it's not really a suitable subject for entertainment. And I know that you could say that maybe the Second World War isn't a suitable subject for entertainment, and maybe nothing is a suitable subject for entertainment, but I've always had something against murder mysteries, so I'm not going to write one of those. I think I'd more like to write some kind of something about why we do what we do and the power of the story. I don't know. But at any rate, I don't want to get involved with the mystery of what's happening in the past, because I want to keep that mystery. That's probably something that you've learnt about me over the weeks and months and years we've been doing this podcast, Martin. I'm forever saying, and this is a mystery. Mm. And I like it that way. I want to learn something, but I don't want the people to completely step out of the shadows. It's the mystery that makes it exciting to me.
Well, watch this space. Who knows? There could be a novel coming at some point from Helen Geek. And well, who knows what mystery it will... It's unlikely to come from Martin Williams, I would say. But
if it comes from Martin Williams, I will be looking in the acknowledgements to find out whether I'm suitably acknowledged.
Ah, I see. Well, there we go. Thank you so much for getting in touch with all your questions. It's been very, very good fun.
Yes, and next week we're getting very excited about our latest Time Team film, which is due out at the end of the month. It's part two of The Princely Burial from Cherrington. So that is going to be fascinating.
It is, and you're going to learn lots more about it in our next episode. It includes the remarkable work of Operation Nightingale, which we've mentioned many times before on this podcast. It uses archaeology to help current and former service personnel.
So join us for that next week on the Time Team podcast.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.